Hello and welcome to iVow. I'm Jenny Prisk, your host for this podcast conversation. And today we are delighted to welcome to our conversation Sabrina Maula-Baksh of the Republic of Trinidad and Tobago, the twin island country in the beautiful Caribbean. Sabrina is a founding member of the Women's Institute for Alternative Development, called WINAD, which became the Secretariat for the Reduction of Armed Violence. The work culminated in the historic signing of the Arms Trade Treaty by CARICOM, the Caribbean Community Region. Sabrina is a former councilwoman and deputy mayor of her city of San Fernando. She holds an MSc in Gender and Development from the University of the West Indies. I'm delighted to welcome to our conversation Sabrina Maula-Baksh.
Thank you so much. I'm quite happy to be here.
And we're delighted that you are in residence as a woman peacemaker at the Joan B. Kroc Institute for Peace and Justice at the University of San Diego. And Sabrina, I've read that although women account for 49% of the population in Trinidad Tobago, they constitute nearly 55% of the workforce in the country. So would you tell us what life is like for women and girls in Trinidad and Tobago?
Thank you, and thank you for allowing me this opportunity to share the reality of women and girls in Trinidad and Tobago. Women in Trinidad and Tobago and the experiences of women in Trinidad and Tobago, they are no different to the trends worldwide. And the figures that you just quoted resonates with world figures as well. So we are no different. Women in Trinidad and Tobago face a particular kind of reality in that our women are highly educated. We have good access to education. We occupy valuable spaces in the corporate world, in the political life. As a matter of fact, at one point in time, we were represented at over 30% in the cabinet and the government of Trinidad and Tobago. So on the books, it looks really well that we are well positioned, we are well placed. But then there is the other side, influenced by our cultural norms, influenced by our traditions, and of course influenced by how we perceive ourselves as women and the concepts of womanhood and how that impacts on us as women and girls. So we have high levels of violence, high levels of domestic violence. Women are still silenced in terms of their voice. So we have a parallel happening. We have, on the surface level, signs of empowerment and signs of women's agency, while at the same time, we have situations of exploitation. We have situations of inferiority. We have situations where women cannot express themselves in the way that they ought to and they need to, in terms of how we express our sexuality, in terms of how we view our bodies, in terms of how we speak and articulate what we need to. So if I go on, I will never stop. So maybe I'll stop at this time so that you can, you know, we can explore this thing in more detail and we will be more relevant to, you know, the conversation that we're having.
Oh, certainly. I appreciate that. And you have opened some interesting doors. Mm-hmm. So you've been an activist for a number of years in your country. Was it the violence, the gender violence, that drew you to becoming an activist?
Definitely. I would say that it is solely responsible for me becoming an activist. From early in my life, I recognized that I was disadvantaged. I recognized that being a girl played an important part of me being disadvantaged simply because of a culmination of factors. I was a girl in an East Indian family, of course, which is very patriarchal. I was dark-skinned. I was the first child, and not in an East Indian family, there's a preference for boys. I was poor. I experienced poverty. I was born and lived in a community where there were predominantly African culture. And at that time, African culture was recognized as the dominant culture. So there were levels of inferiority experienced by me. So those culmination of factors led me to understand I was treated differently and I am different. And the different was not a nice different. It was not a powerful difference. So from early, I realized that power, authority, privilege were not associated with girls. Mm-hmm. And I really did not like that feeling, mm-hmm. and how it was manifested in the violence that I witnessed around me. So I made a vow that, listen, this does not feel good, and this is not right.
So was it easy to get that activism started? How did you do it?
It was quite different, actually. So mm-hmm. I recently realized that really my strategies were kind of normal, but at the same time different. So what I did was I realized that the boys had the privilege. So mm-hmm. I had a lot of males in my family. So I just wanted to do everything that they were doing. So when they went out to play football, when they went out to climb trees, when they went out to do all the things that they were doing, I would go with them. You know, and mm-hmm. then I would become better at what they were doing. So I would learn to play cricket. I would learn to play football. I became part of the cricket team in my village. I was the only girl. I learned to climb trees, and I learned mm-hmm. to climb better than the boys. So I was able to access what I considered to be the places and the spaces of privilege and power, which I found was very strategic. And it gave me a new perspective on how I perceived myself as a girl. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed being in those spaces. So from early, I recognized that being in certain spaces was beneficial to me. And that was a valuable strategy.
It sounds so interesting the way that all came about. And so as a consequence of those brothers and all that wonderful physical activity, you were able to move forward. Was that hard? Were you oppressed or suppressed by any male-dominated organizations or the government or with your work?
No, I wasn't. I must say that my dad always pushed us to acquire our education. He mm-hmm. placed a lot of emphasis on education. Mm-hmm. And he always said to us that education was key to us getting out of poverty. So he encouraged us to acquire, and he did everything in his power to ensure that we got access to education. Mm-hmm. However, I think what was very instrumental in my moving forward were the kinds of other activities that I became involved in. So from early, I was always inclined to join organizations. So for example, I was part of Brownies in my primary school. I was part of the Red Cross. And being involved in those kinds of activities opened me up to new ways of thinking and new patterns of involvement and mm-hmm. engagement.
And so as you pursued this work, it took you into the becoming a co-founding member of the Women's Institute for mm-hmm. Alternative Development, WINAD. Mm-hmm. What was that work about? Because it culminated in CARICOM, which is a very, very big treaty on the world stage today.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Yes, well, that was an interesting journey, simply because my engagement prior to WINAD had been relegated to community development, working with women and in rural communities and urban communities throughout Trinidad and Tobago, and of course through my political engagement as well. So it was a long journey that had me working towards women's development. Mm-hmm. So I always had that backing. I always had that kind of thinking. So a good friend of mine, Folade Mututa, we go back a long way. We were exposed to very radical thinking through our engagement with a political organization called NJAC.
NJAC
means the National Joint Action Committee.
Thank you. It was
a black movement. And it was strange because I'm an East Indian woman who was exposed to black consciousness and black thinking and black ideology. So the exposure to this engendered me a certain kind of conscious thinking, which was a pioneer thing for me in terms of my movement and in terms of how I was able to analyze and critically analyze where I was, who I wanted to be, where I needed to go. Mm-hmm. So because of that close association with Folade, she kind of headhunted. So she said, I want you, Sabrina. I need you to be involved in WINAD and some movement towards making this place a better place for women and girls. Mm-hmm. So we started on the journey of WINAD. Mm-hmm. So that's how we got going. And starting from a small campaign of No Guns for Christmas for Children. Mm-hmm. That was our first engagement. Mm-hmm.
And now, by that you mean toy guns, I think, as gifts.
Yes, toy guns, simply because at Christmas time, everybody wanted to get guns, especially for the boys. And we were saying, if you start to perceive of the guns as toys and equate it with happiness and fun, then you do not really see the damage that it is creating in our country, because at the same time, because of the attempted coup in our country, and because also of the widespread situation of criminal activity associated with illegal drugs and the use of guns and gangs, we were seeing an increase in gun violence and murders in our country.
And did that movement stop the progression of guns for children, and ultimately, I guess, was part of leading to the signing of the treaty?
It was the first step. Mm-hmm. We cannot, and we're not in a position to gauge if it stopped, but certainly we started to create the awareness. Mm-hmm. And we started to bring the awareness into the national conversation. I think that's a very important strategy.
Yes,
we would agree. The ability to place certain buzzwords, certain notions into national conversations. So I think that was critical for us. Nobody else was dealing with the issue of gun violence, and certainly not a women's organization. We realized very, very early, and we were very particular about applying a gender lens and a gender analysis to any and everything that we are engaged in. And certainly nobody looked at gun violence and how it impacted girls, how it impacted women in communities. And we realized that we needed to look at that and make our interventions relevant to that.
Mm-hmm. That was a very smart move. And we know that, of course, women and girls are always, and children, are always affected by wars and violence of any sort. So with your work with WNAD and your work also as a councillor and a deputy mayor, a councilwoman, and a deputy mayor, do you feel now, as you review your work and look at the current situation, are women gaining respect in Trinidad and Tobago?
To an extent, but it's a very difficult struggle, simply because of even how we understand respect. Respect is not only about saying good morning and good afternoon and greeting each other in a respectful manner, but it stems from how you perceive women. And if you perceive women at different levels and as being inferior to you and as being relegated to only certain spaces, it means that you will see women as property. Mm-hmm. You will see women as needed to be led. Mm-hmm. You will see women as requiring guidance. And once you approach women from that perspective, then how you position yourself in relation to that, it's a wrong notion and it's a wrong premise. So that's the problem that we are experiencing, because of deeply embedded notions brought on by our cultural traditions. The perspective of looking at women, it's skewed from a male perspective. So it is coming from a position of power. It is coming from a position of privilege. It is coming from a position of authority, which positions women not on a position, on a notion of equality, but in a space of inequality. So issues of social justice, issues of justice even, issues of equal access still remains problems for women in our society.
Do you expect with your time at the Institute for Peace and Justice that you will gain tools that you can take back to your country to implement that will do any work in the realm of increasing that, I don't want to keep using the word respect, but that the stages and the platforms and the leveraging of women?
Well, this is my hope. Certainly, we have been on a particular path in Trinidad and Tobago from a local perspective, from a local context. And certainly the issue of gun violence and the illegal arms trade, it's national in scope, and it's especially relevant now in light of the global scenario where we have so many conflicts and tense moments with the use of arms and the potential reality of wars. So it's always a good strategy to even inform what you do based on global trends, because certainly we are impacted by global trends. So, for example, we do not manufacture guns in Trinidad and Tobago, yet over 90% of the murders are done with illegal guns coming into the country. So certainly we are mindful of the impact of global situations on us, even relevant to climate and how it impacts us. The Caribbean was recently devastated, certain countries, by hurricanes. And there are some connections between the global climate situation and how it is manifesting itself in local climate change. So certainly this kind of opportunity will help to give me a voice in bringing into the national space, listen, how you do things impacting us. And you need to rethink how you do things. And you need to understand that when you make a decision, it is not only relevant to you. You have to start thinking about the consequences of your actions, not only in your individual space, but in the national space. So it is giving us a voice in the national arena, and we get the chance to say, listen, you need to rethink the way that you are doing things. So certainly I would want to use this opportunity to do that.
And I can also hear through your comments that what you are conveying to your audiences while you're here in San Diego will change our thinking and have us thinking differently as well. So unfortunately, Sabrina, our interview is coming to a conclusion. But in closing, would you share with us what you'd like us to really know about Trinidad and Tobago? Many of us know it's a glorious spot on the Caribbean, but there are much more important things about your country as well. So what would you like to understand?
Well, certainly, I would just like you to know that we really are a beautiful people. We really are a beautiful country, rich in culture. And I would invite the listening audience to Google and go to the internet and look up our carnival and our steel band, really magnificent, our diverse nature of the influences of Islam and Hinduism and how it manifests itself into the rainbow people that we are. At the same time, we are impacted by what's happening internationally. And very much of our culture is so influenced by North American culture. That is reaping a lot of havoc in our country.
Do you want to go into a detail or two?
Yes. So a lot of our young people, a lot of youth and their behavior and the influence of North American culture, the influence on our young people especially, it's very troubling. So you have the black culture, the rap culture, the issues of how women are portrayed, the issues of beauty and the false notion of beauty associated with being thin, being white. And bodies and how those bodies are valued, which is coming from a North American perspective. That influences our young people to a great extent. So we are struggling with getting our young people to understand and develop and truly appreciate a black identity, a Caribbean identity, a national identity. And for us as activists, as women activists, that may be a difficult period for us, especially as we forge to establish a Caribbean identity and to understand feminism in a Caribbean and a local context. We have acknowledged that we need to examine that a little more closely and how that aligns with international perspectives of feminism.
And it sounds, in conclusion, which is not surprising, that in Trinidad and Tobago you have very similar problems that perhaps have come from North America, but that we are also fighting with and dealing with also. So I just want to express to you our gratitude for your erudite remarks, and thank you again for joining us today, Sabrina Maulabaksh of the Republic of Trinidad and Tobago.
Thank you. It has been my pleasure. And for the listening audience, if you would like to engage with me further, I remain open to such a reality. Thank you so much.
And thank you.